Neil, most of your time in Southeast Asia has been spent in Indochina. It'd be fair to say that, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's true, yes.
How did you first go there?
Well, I was based in Singapore and I was covering the confrontation of Malaysia, newly formed Malaysia, by Indonesia. Then, of course, the Vietnam War was beginning to get much more serious. And so I went there just 2 or 3 weeks after I arrived in Southeast Asia in February of 1964. I went to Vietnam first because that was the major battlefield, but that first visit was cut short by coup d'etat in Laos, which was also, of course, under communist attack, and there was a strange tripartite government of neutralists, communists and right-wing people there.
One of the many coup d'etats.
One of the many coup d'etats, and of course subsequently in South Vietnam there were 9 changes of government. Difficult to call them coup d'etats because the same man bounced up like a rubber ball each time, General Nguyen Khan, until he was finally deposed in 4 or 5 months into 1965.
The old Asia hands, which I suppose you must count yourself as one, look back to those days in Laos as being rather vintage times, don't they?
They were. The war was not very serious in the sense that there weren't many people killed. The Laos had an admirable sense of destiny and an admirable approach to war. That is that each side, the Pathet Lao, the communist Pathet Lao on one side, and there were very few Vietnamese communist soldiers in Laos at that time, and the right-wing troops supported by America on our side, as one might say, used to send each other little signals that they were about to attack, and quite often they'd go into a Buddhist pagoda to bring Buddha down on their side. Defending side, quite rightly, would retreat in the face of this threat. Attackers would then announce a great victory, held victory celebrations and parties and things. There were usually were a few shots fired, but they were only fired from the one side because the others had already gone, having vacated the position. When they wanted it back, they would do the same in reverse. So there were a few people killed, and Laos was a very gentle land with only 2 or 3 million people, and lots of elephants. Was known as the land of 1 million elephants and a very beautiful country, maybe the Switzerland of Southeast Asia.
And as far as the correspondent was concerned, he lived at the Constellation Hotel? And
oh, the marvellous Constellation, yes. That was run by a man who'd lived nearly all his life in Laos, but he was had a French father and a Chinese mother. That seemed to fit in very well in Laos, actually, the combination. God, what was his name?
Maurice.
Maurice had never been to France, actually. He was a typical Indo-Chinese, that is, of mixed blood with some French. And he'd lived in Saigon and in Hanoi, but most of his life in Laos. And he ran a little bit of opium and marijuana on the side, as well as helping newsmen. He was a very good helping newsman. He knew everybody. At a very high level, so when you wanted passes to go anywhere or visa extensions or changing money, which was very important, not only into Lao money, but when you were moving out with travellers' cheques and cash in all sorts of currencies of the area, he would exchange them and give you notes to get real money in another place.
Well, there was quite a remarkable collection of people used to live in the Constellation Hotel.
Oh, yes, there were. I mean, there was, I will remember Eric, I forget his surname, but he was ex-Foreign Legion. He was a German, and he had come to fight in the First Indochina War, that is, with the French against the Vietnamese, between the end of World War II, in which he served in the Hitler's army, of course, and then for reasons known only to Eric, he joined the French Foreign Legion. And he was quite happy to be sent immediately to Indochina. I think he wanted to be as far away from Germany as possible. And when the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, Eric, who was at Dien Bien Phu, one of the French Foreign Legionnaires, and captured by the North Vietnamese, decided to remain on in Indochina, and the North Vietnamese allowed him. Well, he married a North Vietnamese girl, which was under communist control, of course, Ho Chi Minh's government, decided that it wasn't quite for him, and immigrated to Laos, and that seemed to be just for him because he ran a rather dubious little airline which did work for the American Central Intelligence Agency and carried a bit of marijuana. Of course, any little airplane did that anyway. And a host of other things. But Eric could also cart your furniture down to Bangkok and have it shipped on elsewhere in the world, and could get you a little bit of gold if you needed it, and anything that was going, Eric could get for you.
At that time, I recall that Vientiane was one of the few places where there were, say, one of the few places where there was a Chinese embassy, a Russian embassy. In other words, you could have a diplomatic melange that wasn't possible anywhere else.
Oh, absolutely, because of the alleged neutrality and tripartite government of Laos, with its communist third, its right-wing third, and its neutralist third. Therefore, every government in the world, practically, and every important government anyway, recognized it. The United States, Russia, Communist China, and the government of Laos, the neutralist government of Laos, recognized practically every government was going also, including North and South Korea, North and South Vietnam, both represented there, so you could go from they were fighting bitterly just in the next country. But you could go to and visit either embassy. Also East and West Germany, both very strong. They were both giving aid to Laos, and as was Russia and as was the United States, of course. Meanwhile, in the battlefield between the two areas controlled by the left wing and right wing, in a sort of area in which the right wing neutralists really fought the left wing neutralists, they're the ones who did the fighting, the Russian and Chinese supplied communist side battled the American supplied right wing side. And of course, in Vientiane, the administrative capital, they were going to diplomatic parties and exchanging pleasantries over cocktails together.
But behind this sort of comic opera situation, a real business was being done, doubtless.
Oh, yes, yes, real business. I think even with that strange situation, it did in fact save Laos, that tripartite situation, because it gave a facade of neutrality and peace, which, although it didn't exist, still the mechanics were in place for much later, when the communists were gaining control of all of Indochina. Laos was handed over more or less peaceably, and so few Laotians died in the war. I mean, quite a number of thousands did, but it could have been almost genocidal.
On the lighter side, there was a famous bar in Vientiane in those days, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, there were several famous bars. There was one...
The White Horse?
No, the White Rose.
The White Rose, wasn't it?
It was the White Rose. That was very famous. It was along the banks of the Mekong River. And it was candlelit when I first went to it. I think it remained so, not because there wasn't electricity, because it gave a better atmosphere, I suppose, for the fun and games that used to go on there. It also had a dirt floor for most of its working life, and girls would dance. They had certain innovations to their dancing. They were one of the first strippers in the so-called Western world or civilized world. They were certainly topless all the time, and usually used to do a bit of a strip with dancing, and curious and very interesting little innovations where girls would smoke any number of cigarettes at the same time whilst talking to you. That was because the cigarettes weren't in their mouth, of course. They were elsewhere. You could meet all sorts of interesting people at the White Rose too, of course. I mean, there were obviously the American community, and but tucked away in the corner, you'd often find the Russians. I never did see the Red Chinese, actually. I'll grant them that. I never saw them there. But I did see the North Vietnamese, and quite often the Russians. Of course, the communists took over in 1975, and that spelt the end of the White Rose. They did keep going for a little while, but the communists thought that I'd had enough of all that liberty.
When did you first get your real... Again, my mind's not working this morning. When did you get your first real taste of combat? And remembering at this time, of course, that you were there principally as a photographer, cine cameraman.
I had had just a taste of it in Borneo with the Gurkha troops and British troops fighting there, but not real combat. I'd never been fired at in Borneo. But it was, of course, in South Vietnam, and it was also early in 1964 in the Mekong Delta, Mekong River Delta, south of Saigon, which was the major battlefield at that time, simply because half the population of South Vietnam lived in that area. That is 7 million people, 7 to 8 million people. And the battle was on even then in 1964, before the Americans arrived. There were American advisors, but no American soldiers. The battle was on for the hearts and minds of the people, and that was their phrase they used. I went down to the Delta with troops that I got to know rather well, and I well remember the battalion commander's name was Dai Wee Long, Captain Long. He'd already been 10 years a field commander. He was only in his early 30s, but he's already 10 years experience. And I don't know how I ever survived that early experience, or I don't know how I survived over the next couple of years, because I was very inexperienced and I really didn't know what I was doing at all. Except that Dai Wee Long told me very early, remember one thing, watch the soldiers, tread in their footsteps, like good King Wenceslas told the page boy, tread in my footsteps and you'll be safe. And that was a golden rule for somebody as inexperienced as I was. The other thing was, of course, do exactly what the soldiers do. Hit the deck when they do. Respond to every situation as they do. Even when they advance, stick with them, because it's no good staying back when they advance because you're on your own.
What happened on that first occasion?
It was a very typical situation. We splashed across the paddy fields, I well remember, and approached a tree line, and it was very obvious to everybody else that the Viet Cong were in there, as they were, and we put it under fire. They put us under fire. In the end, we had three or four killed. I think there were eight of them, and they were all killed. We captured the Viet Cong flag. It was always there, and Captain Long presented me with the Viet Cong flag. And that situation was repeated many times over in the Delta over the years following.
You said that you were lucky to stay alive for those first 2 years. What sort of things were you learning in that time?
Well, a lot of what one had to learn was to select the unit that you were going to go with, because the South Vietnamese Army at that time, and for many years, had a very bad reputation, and I never subscribed to that anyway, although I didn't know in the beginning, of course. I accepted the word of people who told me that their army was no good and they'd have me killed and all sorts of things, and they would desert me in times of stress and they'd run away everywhere. I never ever did see them run away. But one had to learn to select a unit that you had confidence in. Now, if you didn't have confidence in it, whether it was good, bad or indifferent, didn't matter. If you didn't have confidence in it, you better not go, because the tension was too great and you would react in a stupid manner under stress. If you had confidence in the people you were with, then you were much more likely to be cool under fire and in a bad situation. The only way you could do that was tentatively spend time in less dangerous situations with the unit you were concerned with. What you did was to try and get a good evaluation of a unit. It would most likely be better to be a full-time army unit. It would most likely be better to be a full-time fighting unit, that is, regular army, because the paramilitary, the part-time soldiers, didn't have enough experience. If they were regular army, full-time soldiers, you wanted one that had lots and lots of experience, that were in combat all the time, so they developed a sixth sense and an instinct for certain situations. All of them were not well equipped. Few of them were well equipped, in actual fact. But that didn't matter so well as their instinct for a situation and their experience in any given situation. Also, a lot depended on the food you took, because it was Asian food you were eating, and particularly water. They could at times drink the water Westerner, inexperienced with that, and his metabolism, his whole system, unaccustomed to it, could never drink the paddy field water. So you could die of thirst whilst being surrounded by paddy field water. So you had to be careful always to take tablets for the water and to carry food that could keep, dried food, or not tins because they were too heavy, and get to know the unit right down to the man. I mean, you wanted to know the soldiers as well as the commander. The commander quite often was not good, and you had to watch that. If he was a political appointment or appointed to command a unit because of his influence or money, well, it's best not to be with him unless he does happen to be also good. A man that's reached his position by experience and his worth as a soldier obviously is a much better proposition from your point of view.
We're talking about the early 60s, and I think at that time you were almost alone, weren't you, as a Western correspondent in actually going out with Vietnamese units on your own?
Yes, very, very few others. There were two people, one photographer, and, well, both of them were photographer-journalists working for an American news agency, one, in fact, was a New Zealander and one was a German, both of them who won Pulitzer Prizes, the top prizes for their profession in America.
Who were they?
One was a man named Horst Fast, a photographer, who'd won two Pulitzer Prizes, one of them in Vietnam, and the other was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Peter Arnett of New Zealand. They worked for the American Associated Press. There was one or two Australians. There were one Australian-based...
You said there was one or two.
There were one or two Australians. Don Simmons of the Australian Broadcasting Commission was there for over a year. Pat Burgess, who's a journalist from Sydney, visited a number of times over a long period, 10 years, I guess. He would come every year for a certain amount of time. But otherwise, just the odd journalist or correspondent would go out, and there were anything from 200 to 600 or 700 journalists, depending on the situation, living or in South Vietnam at any given time. And so, although in the very early years, very early times I was there, there were never any more than about 200. When the American build-up came in early 1965, the number of journalists quickly rose too.
And who went out with the Americans when they did go out?
Yes, who went out with the Americans. And so from 1965 through 1968, particularly, almost nobody went with the ARVN, as it was called, ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. They were just simply called ARVN. I became known as the ARVN man simply because I was the only one who went out. Even my German and New Zealand friend, because of their association with the American company, had to cover the Americans. I can't think of any one person, photographer, cameraman or journalist, who went at all with the ARVN during those years. I don't recall ever seeing anybody. One American cameraman asked me once to take him, and he collapsed before midday on the first day because it was pretty hard with the Americans. You were taken everywhere by helicopter, taken into what might be quite a dramatic situation, and an hour later taken out on a helicopter back to your ice creams and air-conditioned headquarters. But with the ARVN, they didn't have all the facilities. Quite often you went into battle in trucks and then walked for days and days from before dawn, before light, until after light, because you didn't give away your position where you were staying overnight, so you had to walk through into darkness.
Neil, why did you do this? I mean, you could have performed, as far as your employers were concerned, an adequate coverage by going out with the Americans and coming back after an hour to your air conditioning and ice creams, as you put it. Why did you keep doing this?
Well, I was there over a year before the Americans came, and I got to know many Vietnamese and liked them, and the Vietnamese people I got to like very well. And I thought that the situation, the war, should be accurately reported from both sides. I didn't necessarily have the strongest anti-communist leanings, although all my friends obviously are on the anti-communist side. I just thought that the Vietnamese people needed to work it out themselves, and the real situation should be presented, and it was our responsibility to do that, to foreign correspondents. After all, are the only people in those situations who can get to the scene of the action or cover a war, and who are allegedly non-aligned, who allegedly are absolutely neutral, and should be very, very fair, very accurate. The what I thought was the unfair thing from the time the Americans came until the time they announced that they were going to pull out, which was in 1968, or announce a limited withdrawal, in that time, the impression given to the world was that the Americans were doing almost all of the fighting, while the inefficient and cowardly Arvin were sitting back and doing nothing. And that was not true. And the international press should accept responsibility for that, for not telling the truth. It was inaccuracy by omission. The figures will show very clearly, the figures were available all the time, that the Arvin, the South Vietnamese army, lost at least 50% more men during that period than the Americans, and it was constant, week after week after week. On only 3 weeks, and I had the figures for all that time, I used to follow it week by week, on only 3 weeks in 3 years did the Americans lose more soldiers than the South Vietnamese. And therefore, I thought it was up to me, even though it was one lone figure, to follow the Arvin. And also, covering for hours and days on end, you got a true feeling for the situation, and I hope presented to the television viewer, at least give them some partial idea of what it was like to be a South Vietnamese soldier.
The thing about television coverage of war, of course, is that you've got to be there. It has to be one of the ultimate high-risk occupations, I suppose, and you did this constantly for many years. Yeah. What was a kind of a typical day, if you like, in the life of a business cameraman in Vietnam in those days?
A typical day would be in the field, but I think a typical period of a few days is more to the point. I would be in Saigon, for example, and get up early in the morning. Every morning that I was in Saigon, I'd be up at 6 to 6:30, and I'd be on the streets and checking the available sources of information by 7:30. If there was something very worthwhile going on in the field, and there often was, or if I really wanted combat film or film outside of Saigon to illustrate an ongoing story, I would then go straight out to the airfield, Saigon Airport, and take a flight to anywhere. And you could do that. You didn't have to have papers. You didn't have to do anything. You just have to turn up out there. And it was the busiest airport in the world because of all the military traffic. There were two planes or aircraft landing or taking off every minute for 24 hours of the day on an average. Of course, the daylight hours were very, very busy. So you could turn up and say, I want to go to the Mekong Delta, it's a certain place, and you'd be on a helicopter within an hour, or you'd be on a flight, American planes. You would then get to the small airfield you were going, and make contact.
Small airfield you were going to.
You would then get to the small airfield you're going to, and make contact with the Vietnamese commander of the area, whom I would invariably know from previous trips, or I'd know his name, but I'd certainly know the situation all around. I'd know what units were there, where they were fighting, what were the areas controlled by the Viet Cong.
You'd talk to him directly, what, in French?
By that time, after a few months, I spoke a little Vietnamese, which got better as the years went on. I never did speak Vietnamese that you'd speak in the drawing room, because it's a pretty racy language among fighting soldiers, and my Vietnamese was learnt mainly from soldiers or people that we'd call lower class, that is, little educated people in the countryside, marvellous people, but a very racy language, lots of swearing. They swear almost as much as Australians, sometimes more. And So I would speak in a mixture of French and Vietnamese, or English and Vietnamese, or of the English, French and Vietnamese, depending what the commander or the person I was speaking to was more fluent.
Important point you got through.
I got through, yes, got through to it. And so I would then, probably by midday on that day, I would most likely be in the field. And there I would stay for probably 3 days with the South Vietnamese, day and night. There was no resupply. There were no pizza helicopters coming down like there were with the Americans. There
was pizza, really with pizzas?
Yes, really with hot pizzas coming out to the American troops in the field, and ice cream. And ice cream, that would be for the evening meal. It was deplorable. Of course, it was great for the Viet Cong, not that they got the pizzas or the ice cream, but they could smell it literally like animals in the jungle. And that's not to say they're animals, but their senses were developed to such an extent that they could smell the cigarettes, and they could smell the shaving cream and the toothpaste and the pizzas and the everything else within. If that's, of course, in addition to seeing the helicopters wheeling around and dropping them all these things, and if there were no helicopters to hear the American transistor radios, half the soldiers used to carry a little transistor radio with a earphone, little earphone attachment, in one ear quite a lot of the time as they were going through the jungle, allegedly alert and looking for the Viet Cong. But of course the ARVN, the South Vietnamese, had nothing like that. And we had to put our little tablets in the paddy field water to purify it, and we carried dried fruits and dried fish and supplemented that into a sort of with weeds, really, but okay, into a soup once a day. You didn't eat anything during the day. You ate a little bit in the morning, usually some dried meats or something, like jerky, and then in the evening, if you're lucky, you'd have a something, what we'd call a hot meal, would be hot soup usually, or a mixture of those things.
During tea, right?
Yes, you'd eat something like jerky, cold, in the morning before dawn, with some purified water to wash it down. You'd eat nothing during the day, usually. There were exceptions. Unless you come on to a banana grove or something like that. You might be lucky to get coconuts, but you had to be alert because the ARVN used to penetrate deep into Viet Cong country. The Americans didn't. They used to go onto the periphery and then bulldoze their way through, sometimes literally bulldoze their way through, with bulldozers in the van, as one might say, having decimated the whole area anyway with blanket bombing and artillery strikes. The ARVN, the South Vietnamese, didn't have that. They didn't have the facility to do that. So they walked through it and sought their enemy in that way. And, of course, in that way they usually found them, and therefore destroyed, killed more of the enemy than the Americans. The Americans really didn't kill too many. They killed a lot of Vietnamese.